A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. As I mentioned yesterday, we are going to be talking about the Supreme Court's Friday conference, which features nearly 10 cases. Well, actually, several dozen cases dealing with the Second Amendment. A lot of these cases, though, are 922G challenges, permitted persons cases that, don't necessarily present difficult questions for the Supreme Court, right? I mean, you may have violent offenders who are arguing that their Second Amendment rights were violated. The Supreme Court has made it pretty clear that, you know, if you're a dangerous person, you can be deprived of your right to keep your arms. But there are, I think, again, close to 10 cases that are at least worth keeping an eye on. And we'll be talking about those cases, as well as another case that has actually been flying under the radar, but does provide the court with the opportunity to address right to carry reciprocity, or the fact that right now our right to bear arms doesn't extend across state lines, unlike any other enumerated right. So we are going to talk about that, but we're also going to talk about a situation in San Francisco, where the sheriff there, let me make sure I've got the headline. Yeah, this is from sfpublicsafety.news, shining a light on violent crime in the city. As they report, the San Francisco sheriff apologizing for lapsed CCW permits, blames budget cuts for renewal delays. So this is not an issue that is confined solely to San Francisco. We're seeing similar issues in Los Angeles County, maybe some other California counties. New York licensing division, the NYPD licensing division, New York City, taking its sweet time processing applications. I don't know if they've run into if existing carry holders have run into an issue with their permits not being renewed in time, but you can submit your renewal application 4 months, 5 months ahead of time in Los Angeles. There's no guarantee that the sheriff's department is going to process it before your permit actually expires. And that's exactly what's happening in San Francisco right now. The San Francisco sheriff, again, blaming this on budgetary issues, but Paul Miyamoto apologizing this week. After acknowledging that concealed carry permits issued by his office have been allowed to expire because his office has not approved or denied, but they've not processed these renewal requests in time. He said, "We've experienced administrative delays in processing renewals, and I take full responsibility for the sheriff's office failure to process and renew CCW permits, which resulted in some unintentionally expiring. This should not have happened." Okay. I mean, listen, it's great that the sheriff is acknowledging that this is happening. It's great that the sheriff is taking responsibility for the problems within his office. That does not change the fact, though, that there are people who have done everything that they're supposed to do in order to exercise their right to keep and bear arms, and they are unable to do so because of the sheriff's inaction. I mean, that's just a simple fact. Again, according to sfpublicsafety.news, the sheriff's office created a lengthy process that for many applicants took 18 months and imposed some of the strictest requirements in the state, including an interview with a psychologist, which is actually not as uncommon, unfortunately, as you might think. 163 permits issued by the sheriff's department after the Bruin decision, initially valid for 2 years, they're now expiring. Renewals are pending. Sheriff Miyamoto says the delays are the direct result of significant shortages within our professional staff ranks. Due to city budget cuts, we are currently operating with only 63% of our normal professional staffing levels. That, by the way, is the same excuse offered by the sheriff in Los Angeles County as to why it is taking so long to process initial applications as well as renewals. Well, we just don't have the staff. Be that as it may, you have a statutory obligation in California to process these permits in 120 days, which, by the way, is far too long. I mean, that's just far too long a window. But that's what the state of California gives these agencies. Unfortunately, there's no recourse whatsoever provided in California law for an individual who waits longer than 120 days to hear back from their sheriff's department. So while the state of California says these departments have to process these carry permits within that time frame, nothing happens if they don't, except, well, they get sued by groups like the California Rifle and Pistol Association and the Department of Justice, right? The sheriff went on to say this reduction has had a substantial impact on our ability to process CCW applications and renewals in a timely manner. He says, I want to be clear, we're not attempting to block or limit anyone's lawful right to carry a firearm. Like, again, intended or not, that's the reality. That's the reality. The reality is that some people who, again, had to go through this ridiculous process to obtain a carry license in San Francisco in the first place, they jumped through all of the hoops and hurdles that the state of California and the county of San Francisco put in place. They received their permit. They were able to carry for 2 years. They renewed, or at least they tried to renew their permit in a timely manner. And the sheriff's office couldn't hold up its end of the bargain here. So, intended or not, the consequences remain the same. People's rights are being denied to them. San Francisco Police Department is also authorized to issue concealed carry weapons permits in the city. Spokesman for the new chief there declined to comment to SF Public Safety on his department's issuance of permits and whether his organization has dealt promptly with all renewal applications. That's not good. That's not good. Because, you know, if they've been able to comply, I would think they'd be pretty quick to say, of course, yeah, we're entirely up to date. No problems whatsoever. So hopefully SF Public Safety will file a Freedom of Information Act request. Maybe one of the local gun rights groups in California will file a request too. And we'll see if the problem extends to the city of San Francisco and the police department there as well. But, you know, the Supreme Court said in Bruin that shall issue licensing laws regarding public carry are presumptively constitutional. But that these shall issue regimes could end up violating people's Second Amendment rights if they subjected them to lengthy delays or exorbitant fees. I would add that your rights can also be violated when those lengthy wait times cause you to lose your ability to lawfully carry a firearm. And this is a lawsuit waiting to happen. And again, it doesn't matter what the sheriff's excuse is. They have a duty. That office has a duty to fulfill. And it is failing to do so. And if that's the fault of the Board of Supervisors, go after the board. If that is the fault of the sheriff, go after the sheriff's office. If the blame should be shared, go after both of them. But, you know, the DOJ's Civil Rights Division's new Second Amendment section actively looking for cases to take on. Seems like Sheriff in San Francisco has basically gifted them a lawsuit. And if they don't take action, again, I hope one of the Second Amendment groups will very soon. And maybe we'll be talking about a case against the sheriff appearing in a Supreme Court conference a couple of years from now. So let's shift our focus to what's going to go on at the Supreme Court on Friday. Again, there are 9 different cases that the Firearms Policy Coalition is keeping track of as part of their gun case track. And there are a couple of different issues at play here. So you've got 3 cases dealing with prohibited persons. 2 of them are relists, Vincent versus Bondi, Duarte versus the United States. And then the third case is Zerka versus Bondi. The question in all 3 of these cases is essentially the same. Can somebody be deprived of their right to keep and bear arms because of a nonviolent conviction or conviction for a nonviolent crime that comes with a potential sentence of more than a year in prison? In the case of Melinda Vincent, she wrote a bad check, for about 400 bucks, 17 years ago, was sentenced to probation for that crime. It was eligible again for a prison sentence, but she didn't receive one. At the time, Melinda Vincent was homeless. She was a drug addict. She has since turned her life around. She is a counselor now. She works with the state of Utah. She's got her own private practice. She's a single mom. She would like to be able to own a firearm so she can go hunt with her kids, but also for self-defense. She can't do so because Section 922 G1 forbids her from owning a firearm. Stephen Duarte, similar story, a few more convictions for a few more nonviolent offenses, but still nothing in the record that would show he is a dangerous person. Zirka versus Bondi, Salim Zirka, same thing. I think his conviction was for some type of financial crime, maybe some type of a fraud issue. But again, not a violent offense, certainly not, you know, a violent home invasion or anything like that. And we've seen circuit court splits on this issue. You've got some circuits that have said, you know what, Section 922, in fact, Section 922 in general, whether we're talking about G1, which, you know, again, is the ban on people owning firearms if they've been convicted of a crime that's punishable more than a year in prison, 922 G3, which prevents unlawful uses of drugs from owning firearms. Some courts like the Seventh Circuit have just said the entirety of Section 922G is unquestionably protected by the Second Amendment. Or it unquestionably not violates the Second Amendment. You cannot bring a claim using the Second Amendment if you've been, you know, convicted of one of these crimes. Other courts, though, have said that doesn't make a lot of sense. If you actually look at the historic tradition of gun ownership in this country, there is not a tradition of banning everybody convicted of even every felony from owning a firearm. That the tradition instead was that people who were considered dangerous could not own firearms. And so the Third Circuit, for instance, in a case called Range versus Garland, said that Brian Range, who had falsified his income on a food stamp application almost 20 years ago, and again, received probation for that misdemeanor, but it was a misdemeanor punishable by Pennsylvania law by more than a year in prison at the time. So he could no longer own a gun. Third Circuit said he should be able to have his rights restored. The Biden administration was defending the statute, but when Trump took office, the case was pending a cert petition by the DOJ. And Pam Bondi's DOJ decided not to appeal that case. So Range versus Garland, basically dead of the Third Circuit. So this is going to be the first opportunity for the courts to, or for the Supreme Court to really consider this issue. You know, they've already granted cert to U.S. versus Hamani, which is a challenge to 922 G3. And it's, I think it's likely that the court will actually just hold on to a majority of these cases, even if they're not dealing with the same exact statute, they're dealing with, you know, 922 G1 instead of G3. I suspect that what they say in Hamani is going to have implications for other prohibited person statutes. So I would not be surprised. I'd love to see, I've talked about this before. I there's something about Melinda Vincent's case in particular that just resonates with me. And I would love to see the court take up Vincent versus Bondi, but I suspect that they're going to just hang on to these cases. They'll GVR them after Hamani has been decided. So those are the prohibited persons cases that the court will be considering conference tomorrow. Then you've got the hardware ban cases, which are also up for a relist. Gators Custom Guns versus Washington, Duncan versus Bonta, both dealing with magazine bans. Gator's Custom Guns, the Washington State's magazine ban. Duncan versus Bonta, as we talked about with Casas Moros yesterday, dealing with the California's ban, or day before yesterday, dealing with the California's ban on large capacity magazines, quote unquote. And then Viramana's versus Cook County, right? That's the challenge to Cook County's ban on so-called assault weapons. You also, though, have a couple of other hardware cases that'll be discussed in conference for the first time tomorrow. And these are not bans, but restrictions. Very onerous restrictions, because these are NFA items. So you've got Rush versus the United States and Robinson versus the United States. Both of these involve challenges to the NFA's restrictions on short barrel rifles and whether or not those restrictions violate the Constitution. Second Amendment groups have weighed in favor of the court granting cert to one or both of these cases, seeing it as an opportunity for the court to, you know, strike down some or all of the NFA's provisions. Again, I'd love to see it, but I got to tell you, I mean, my thought process is, if the Supreme Court has not yet taken up a ban on so-called assault weapons, I don't think it's ready to hear an NFA case. It's possible, I suppose, that they could grant cert to, you know, let's say Duncan versus Bonta, Viramana's versus Cook County, and one of these NFA cases, and address, you know, bans on semi-automatic firearms, large capacity magazines, and NFA restrictions, not at the same time, necessarily not in one case, but at least in the same term. Possible. I just don't think it's likely. I think we are, if Brett Kavanaugh said last term that we're a term or two away from the court addressing bans on commonly owned semi-automatic rifles like the AR-15, I think we're probably more than a term or two away from the court weighing in on the NFA. Unfortunately. And yeah, you know, it doesn't help that the DOJ is defending these NFA restrictions, you know, basically calling them a modest burden on the Second Amendment. If, in fact, these arms are protected by the Second Amendment, the DOJ has affirmed that suppressors, they believe, are protected by the Second Amendment. But I don't think they've said that about short-barreled rifles or short-barreled shotguns or any other weapons covered by the NFA. So you got, again, the hardware ban cases, the prohibited persons cases. And then you've got a liability case. Gustafson versus Springfield. This is a case involving a lawsuit that was filed by the parents of a teenager. I believe he was 12 or might have been 12 at the time. He was shot and killed by his friend. In Pennsylvania, friend got a hold of his dad's gun. They were messing around with it. And this child was shot and killed. It's a tragic situation. The teen who pulled the trigger, I believe, was ultimately convicted of, I think it was involuntary manslaughter. But the parents decided to sue Springfield Armory, which was the maker of the gun, as well as the FFL who sold the firearm, legally, right? But the argument was that, essentially, Springfield Armory's marketing, the practices of the FFL, that these were the approximate cause of this shooting. The case was dismissed, and I think rightfully so, by the state courts in Pennsylvania. Actually, originally it was upheld. There was a decision that, from a lower court judge, that held that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was unconstitutional. That was overturned by an appellate court in Pennsylvania, and the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ultimately upheld the dismissal of this lawsuit. Jonathan Lowey, who was the attorney working with the Mexican government in Mexico versus Smith & Wesson, I don't know if he's still attached to this case. I know Brady is involved. Yeah, I don't think Jonathan Lowey is attached anymore, but I believe he was at one time. So anyway, this case involves the Gustafsons seeking to sue specifically Mark Gustafson, the father of J.R. Gustafson, seeking to sue a Springfield Armory and, again, the FFL that sold this firearm. Supreme Court doesn't need a grand cert to this case to uphold the lower court decision, right? So I expect that the Supreme Court is just going to deny cert to Gustafson. Again, I could be wrong, but I suspect that a majority of the court believes that the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court got it right in dismissing this case. So those are the nine cases that will be discussed. Well, maybe the nine most likely Second Amendment cases to be granted cert that will be discussed in tomorrow's conference. And again, as much as I'd love to see some of these cases, be granted cert by the Supreme Court, I'm just not confident that a lot of these cases are. I don't think that every one of these cases is just going to be dismissed outright. I suspect that the court is going to actually hang on to some of these cases. And maybe they'll even hang on to Duncan versus Bonna, Gators Customs Guns, Viermanas versus Cook County, while they await the Third Circuit's decision in the case dealing with New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons. That's what Casas Moro said. He wanted to see if they didn't grant cert, at least keep a hold of these cases until you do take a hardware ban case. Because, again, if Duncan versus Bonna is outright denied, then you've got hundreds of thousands of gun owners in California who are likely to become criminals if they just keep a hold of the magazines that they lawfully purchased and possessed. Because California went back and changed the rules a couple of years ago to say that, no, even if you lawfully bought that magazine, you can't keep it anymore, right? So there are real-world implications here if they outright deny cert to Duncan versus Bonas. So, yeah, fingers crossed they, at the very least, hold on to these cases. So it's going to be a busy conference, and there are more cases awaiting the justices as well. You've got Schoenthal versus Raul, which is the challenge to Illinois' ban on concealed carry on public transportation. That's going to be discussed, I believe, at the January 9th conference. There's another case dealing with 922G3, Harris versus the United States. It's also been scheduled for January 9th. Markey versus Massachusetts, which is an interesting carry case. That's been scheduled for the January 9th conference as well. And that deals with right to carry reciprocity. Just like this other case that I wrote about at Variant Arms earlier today, the Gardner case involving a woman who had a Virginia concealed carry permit. She was in Montgomery County, Maryland. Says a guy ran her off the road and then went after her. So she drew her firearm. She didn't discharge it, but just drew her firearm in self-defense. She had a valid Virginia carry permit, which is not recognized by the state of Maryland. Maryland doesn't recognize anybody's permits except Maryland's. So she was arrested and eventually convicted for illegally possessing a firearm in Maryland. She originally filed a pro se cert petition. So she filed it on her own behalf, but, now Cooper and Kirk is representing her, and they're very well respected, firm specializing in Second Amendment issues, which is a positive development. And, at least one justice has taken an interest in this case because the state of Maryland originally waived its right to reply. And, the Supreme Court said, nah, we want to hear from you. Which is a good sign. So it's possible. Now, the timing of that case, and really the timing of Markey versus Massachusetts as well, if the Supreme Court does grant cert, oral arguments would probably be held next fall, not next spring, just because of the way the timing would work out. But that's okay, right? I mean, the court's already granted two Second Amendment cases this term. If they want to start front-loading their next term, I'm okay with that. I'm more than okay with that. So fingers crossed that maybe the court's willing to take up the issue of right to carry reciprocity, which frankly would be a logical place to go after the Bruin decision, right? People have the right to bear arms. Second Amendment is not a second class right. Our right to keep your arms right now stops at the state line. No other enumerated right stops at our state line. So the Second Amendment is being treated like a second class right in that respect. All right. Anyway, we'll have more updates for you. Well, you know, the orders come out Monday morning, so we'll know by the time we start Monday's Cam and Company what, if any, action the Supreme Court has taken on these Second Amendment cases that they discuss tomorrow. But fingers crossed that maybe we'll get some positive action in at least one, and hopefully more than one, of these cases. All right. Before we turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report, let's talk about this for a second. From city streets to mountain trails, your gear should go wherever life takes you. That's why in Modern Rugged Leather, every bag, handcrafted from premium, responsibly sourced leather, designed to look sharp, last long, and tell a story all its own. This is my Modern Rugged Leather bag, and I absolutely love it. As you can see, each stitch, each buckle, each strap reflects timeless craftsmanship. It's backed by a lifetime warranty, because quality shouldn't quit when the adventure begins. And I got to tell you, I mean, this, you know, it is so easy these days to you buy something online, you're not able to look at it, it arrives, and you're like, man, this is not what I expected. When I opened up my box from Modern Rugged Leather and I pulled this out of the bag, I literally went, wow. Because it's immediate, the impression that it makes. Again, the quality craftsmanship just is readily apparent. And it is such a pleasant surprise to see these days. Anyway, again, whether it's the boardroom or the back roads, Modern Rugged Leather helps you carry confidence every step of the way. Modern Rugged Leather, modern style, timeless durability, backed for life. Life takes you places. Make sure your gear keeps up. Shop the full collection and find yours today at modernrugged.com. Again, that is modernrugged.com. All right. Now let's turn our attention to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story from CWB Chicago. I actually had to choose between recidivist reports from CWB Chicago today because they had a couple of them that were doozies. But I decided to go with this one. Electronic monitoring escapee sexually molested 11-year-old girl, according to prosecutors. So we've talked about the issues with electronic monitoring before, right? You can say that somebody who's being monitored is being closely watched, but they're not really. People can cut off these monitors, an alert will go off. Whether or not anybody responds, yeah, it kind of depends on the individual agency. And a lot of times, when these individuals cut off their electronic monitoring, they go on again to commit other crimes. So as Tim Heckey with CWB Chicago writes, a Chicago man who escaped electronic monitoring while awaiting trial for a series of violent robberies on the Chicago Transit Authority is now back in custody. But while he was on the run, he, according to prosecutors, sexually assaulted a child. 21-year-old Devon Credit. Prosecutors last year asked a Cook County judge to keep him in jail without bond on allegations that he participated in what CWB Chicago describes as a violent crosstown robbery spree in Chicago. But Kelly, who CWB Chicago calls the most defendant-friendly judge in the Cook County Court's pretrial division, instead sent Credit home on an ankle monitor. Last month, he escape monitor. Don't know if he cut it off, if the battery died, whatever. But authorities found him in Jasper County, Indiana, this week, where officials say he molested a young girl that he met online. A region news source reporting that the sexual assault case started less than 3 weeks after Credit went AWOL. A woman reported that her 11-year-old daughter was missing from the Chicago area. She told police that the girl had left home without permission. She did have a Life 360 app on her daughter's phone that could track her. It showed the phone in Rensselaer, Indiana. And that's when family members allegedly told police that they suspected the girl was with Credit. The girl's adult sibling found her in Rensselaer back on November 22nd. A affidavit filed with the by the prosecution says the child appeared, quote, either high or intoxicated, 11 years old, and that she was taken to a Comer Children's Hospital for medical evaluation. During an interview, the girl told investigators that Credit had assaulted her in the bedroom of a home in Rensselaer. She also said that she primarily communicated with Credit on Snapchat, and that his name appeared on an associated account. Investigators were able to identify the home. They learned that Credit had actually been staying there for several weeks. Executed a search warrant on December 5th, took Credit into custody. Prosecutors in Indiana have now charged him with child molestation, possession of cocaine, possession of marijuana. As for the CTA robberies, or the reason why he was on electronic monitoring in the first place, Hecky writes that Credit, a guy named Bryant Robinson, and at least two others, began a two-hour crime spree on November 1st of last year at a Red Line station where they stole a victim's headphones. They then got on a Red Line train riding north, mugged a 57-year-old man after they got off the train. The victim told police that 4 minutes around him as he walked. Brian Robinson had rifled through his pockets for valuables, taking the man's cash, tossing the billfold to the ground. Group also accused of robbing a 26-year-old woman that same evening when her boyfriend tried to intervene. Brian Robinson allegedly raised his shirt to display what appeared to be a firearm in his waistband, which would be a no-no on CTA property, you know. And if he was riding that train with a gun, boy, he violated CTA property because that's a gun-free zone. Crew also allegedly grabbed a man by the throat, dragged him between a couple of planters and parked cars, forced him to his knees as they robbed him. Chicago police surveillance camera spotted four people who matched the suspect's descriptions entering the Addison Red Line station a short time later. Officers moved in and arrested them. A pistol-shaped taser allegedly recovered from the crew. By the way, Brian Robinson also was on electronic monitoring for an assault and obstruction case at the time of that robbery spree. I guess, has been convicted since then. And Hecky says that he is a projected release date of April 30th, 2027, which is, frankly, not long at all. All right. So, you know, here we go again, right? I mentioned Schoenthal versus Rule. That's the challenge to Illinois' ban on concealed carry on CTA property, a ban that criminals don't care about. I mean, there have been reports of violent assaults, murders, on CTA trains and buses. And yet the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals says, oh, no, no, there's a national tradition of banning the carrying of firearms in crowded public spaces, which would be like the entirety of downtown Chicago, the entirety of the island of Manhattan. No, there's not a tradition of that. There's certainly no tradition of banning the carrying of firearms on transit. Now, listen, public transportation didn't exist in 1791, but there were no laws passed by states forbidding travelers from bearing arms as they rode on horseback or in a coach. There were some rules laid out by private railroad companies in the 1800s. Regulating carrying, but also allowing some individuals to carry. But the Seventh Circuit, again, just kind of ignored history. Well, I won't say it ignored history. It professed to actually adhere to history. It's just that they ended up rewriting history in order to justify Chicago and Illinois' ban. I wrote at Bearing Arms yesterday that Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division and its Second Amendment section, brought up the concealed carry ban on D.C.'s Metro in an interview earlier this week. So I'm hopeful that that the DOJ will express its interest. It's too late for them to file an amicus brief urging the court to take the case, but they could still send up some unofficial smoke signals. And maybe that's what Harmy Dillon's comments about the D.C. Metro was. A sort of an unofficial smoke signal telling the Supreme Court, hey, we are interested in this issue. And yeah, wouldn't be a bad thing if you address it. All right, on to today's armed citizen story. This, an odd one from the state of Wyoming. Fatal shooting a friend in Sublette County ruled self-defense. It took a while for that determination to be made. Cowboy State Daily reporting that the incident happened back in July in a town called Pinedale, where a couple of friends who had a falling out had met to exchange some items that the other had, and the conflict, or the I guess the meetup, turned into a conflict and a violent confrontation. The Sublette County Sheriff's Office announced on Tuesday that the individual who fatally shot his one-time friend did use reasonable force to preserve his life. Natrona County District Attorney Dan Itzen was the one who had taken a look at this case and initially concluded that, no charges were warranted here. As Cowboy State Daily reports, Craig Rice and Paul Browning had been friends for a number of years. They had a falling out for a variety of reasons. Paul Browning had Craig Rice's animal traps. Craig Rice had Paul Browning's free weights. And so they decided, all right, we'll meet up. We'll give each other, our stuff back. They decided to meet in an alley behind Craig Rice's business in Pinedale on July 11th. There was a summer rendezvous festival going on in the town at the time, but that's not really important. Paul Browning had also asked a third man to accompany him. Browning's truck wouldn't start, so the third man ended up using his truck to go to town with Browning. He had referred, Browning had, to Mr. Rice when talking with the third individual as a, quote, expletive, according to the DA. And on the way to town, Browning noted that he didn't bring a knife or a gun, quote, because he did not want trouble. That's what he told the third individual. But then when he and Rice met up, he got ticked off because not all of the free weights were there. So at that point, they start arguing. Both sides, according to the third man, are accusing the other of being a liar and a thief. According to the DA, the third man could hear Brownie was upset, talking towards Mr. Rice. Rice backed up, drew a firearm, and shot one time, according to the DA, striking Browning in the chest. At the time, Browning was holding one of those animal traps. And, it sounds like this was, I don't know what kind of trap it was. Had the chain attached, so, you stake it down, there's the chain. And depending on, what kind of trap we're talking about here, you've got a pretty heavy metal object. It's almost like a mini mace, right? Or a mini flail. Because it's detached, but you got this chain link, you got a big heavy piece of metal at the end, and he's holding on to essentially the stake at the time. The trap weighed about 2 pounds, so not nothing. You swing that at somebody's head, you can knock them senseless. And Rice felt like his life was in danger. He was worried about being attacked, and maybe that first whack to the head wouldn't kill him, but it might knock him to the ground and give his assailant time to keep attacking him. After Craig Rice fired that shot, he retreated into his office building, telling an individual he felt threatened as Browning had advanced on him. In an interview with investigators, Rice said that this was a rapid escalation. Once Browning had discovered that there were some missing weights, Browning called him a mother bleeper. Picked up the trap, called him the mother bleeper again, said, "I'm going to kill you," according to the DA. Holding the trap by the chain end with what Rice described as rage in his eyes. Rice says he told investigators, "Please, Paul, don't. Please, please." Said he retreated as Browning started to swing the trap at him from about 4 feet away. But he said that he was, quote, 100% sure that Browning was going to kill him, which is the point that he discharged his firearm. The DA said that Browning's, quote, reputation within the community also weighed in to his decision to consider this self-defense. Several years ago, another individual had described an attack in which Browning had grabbed him by the throat, ended up with a cut on his throat. In June of this year, about a month before he was killed, Browning was threatening to kill a utility worker for turning off his water, then said that he would kill law enforcement officers who responded. He also apparently in 2021 got into a physical confrontation, a fight at a grocery store. A woman had described herself as the victim of a road rage incident involving Browning. So it appears like there was a history of, belligerency and violent threats, if not violent acts as well here. And the DA wrote that if he prosecuted the case and it went to trial, Rice would likely advance a self-defense claim. I mean, certainly he would. He says that would put the burden on the prosecutor to disprove the claim. And he said, given the facts described above, the state couldn't meet that burden. So Again, the DA in, I guess, neighboring Natrona County, ruling that this shooting in Sublette County back in July, again, a justified use of force. All right, finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some unarmed citizens in Odessa, Texas, who were able to save a woman and her son from an armed intruder. I give these Good Samaritans all the credit in the world. I can't help but wonder if one or more of them are not carrying a firearm now, because I certainly wouldn't want to confront somebody wielding a knife and a baseball bat threatening to harm others barehanded. But that's apparently what happened on Saturday night. A 13-year-old boy and his 36-year-old mom saved by two neighbors after a guy with a knife and a baseball bat kicked in their front door. When police officers arrived at the scene, the woman and her son said that they had heard their front door being forced open, so they went to go see what was going on, and they said they saw a family acquaintance named Hector Rojas standing there. He had a knife and a bat. The boy said that Rojas started slashing towards him with the knife, and if he hadn't moved, he would have been killed, he said. Meanwhile, a neighbor told officers that he saw two guys pull up in a car. One of them got out, ran towards the front door of his neighbor's home. He said when he heard a commotion, he jumped over his fence, saw that the front door had been kicked open, saw Rojas holding the bat and knife, and he said he knew that his neighbor's husband wasn't home. So he ran in, was able to pull Rojas out with help from his dad, who had also run over to help. The two neighbors said they managed to disarm Rojas, but they said the driver of the car ran up, grabbed the man, and pulled him back into the vehicle, and then they took off into the night. Officers were able to obtain some video footage of the incident. They saw the damage to the front door. They found the bat and knife, by the way. His accomplice managed to grab Rojas, but not the weapons. And eventually they found Rojas as well. He was arrested, booked into the Ector County Jail on suspicion of burglary of a habitation, intended to commit another felony. He's also currently being held on an ICE bond. So Mr. Rojas might be facing some double trouble there in the Lone Star State of Texas going forward. And again, you know, in the right place at the right time. It could be that one or both of these Good Samaritans did have a gun, but the news report doesn't mention that. But again, I can't help but wonder if the son or dad now maybe carrying maybe a little more frequently than they used to, if they were carrying it all before. But regardless, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing at great risk of themselves. These Good Samaritans there in Odessa, Texas, we thank you for your very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. And I want to thank you for being a part of the program as always. I'm looking forward to being back with you on Monday. I think we're going to do a Monday with Mark. I think Mark Walter is going to be with us on Monday's program. And again, we'll be talking about what, if anything, happened at the Supreme Court, as well as taking a look at some of the other big Second Amendment news of the day. Don't forget, you have until December 15th to vote in the Gundies, thegundies.com. John Petrolino, Tom Knighton, both up for Best Two-Way Rider. Bearing Arms Cam & Company facing stiff competition. I mean, there are a lot of great Second Amendment podcasts out there, but honored to be nominated as one of the best podcasts and would certainly appreciate your vote. You can vote once a day at thegundies.com. And again, voting closes on December 15th, so only a few days left to cast your vote. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the weekend. We are going to be keeping you up to date on all of the latest 2A news from across the country. Getting to the point in the year where things kind of slow down, but at the same time, we're getting ready for the start of the 2026 legislative sessions in a lot of states, so we could be seeing some gun control bills be pushed into the hopper. We've already seen a couple in New Mexico and Virginia. We've got more to come, unfortunately. But anyway, check out BearingArms.com between now and Monday. And we'll see you back here for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company then. Until then, though, be well, be safe, and be free.